evening and greetings to all of you. It really was, I hadn't taken time to think about what I was going to do before I came, and so I forgot to reflect on whom I would see. And walking about in the reception hour and seeing so many friends was peculiarly affecting. And it's been a very pleasant evening, and though we have to remember things which give us a pause, it's nevertheless also strongly reaffirming to recognize after all these years that indeed a work has come forth. This is not a mountain that labored in vain, and it's genuinely impressive. All honor to Pierre F. Goodrich, who knew how to introduce moral authority into the deliberations of ordinary life without depriving individuals of the moral authority, indeed, the moral responsibility to chart their own courses. The title of these remarks, Why Liberty, bears no accidental relation to the identical title of a short essay by Goodrich. I aim to dwell, to meditate on the meaning of Goodrich's essay towards the end of justifying the conclusion I have just announced. Before I take up this task, however, I want to join in the tributes that are paid to Don Lipset, who fully merited our recognition and respect. I can think of no one more fitting, and no way more fitting, to express our recognition to than to give voice to what, in my eyes, Don Lipset accomplished. In a word, for the Philadelphia Society and for so many of us, he shepherded that slow but certain progress from the clumsiness of baby steps to the mature seriousness of gentlemanly vocation. It was 29 and a half years ago I first appeared on a Philadelphia Society platform. And two memorable events transpired then, and each to make me blush. First, and in that same program, the famous physicist Shockley spoke. After he completed his account of the genetic bases of racial differences in performance, my mentor, Dr. Jerry Pornell, with whom I sat, rose in high-pitched dudgeon, his index finger seemingly planted in my head, saying, "How can you say that? See my student here." And so on, in terms which as emphatically urge me to seek precisely not to be seen, as they emphatically made his point. I wonder even now how I can laugh about the experience. It was a defining experience, which made me realize the capital importance of individuality. The second event transpired during my own presentation on the subject of the New Left. Remember them? Well, I was part of a panel, and on that panel also sat Dr. Harry Jaffa, whom I had not met before. I delivered remarks on the cogency of which I congratulated myself. Then I listened to Jaffa. The experience I really can't describe, save to say, with Socrates, that I then knew that the only thing I knew was that I knew nothing. And then and there was determined the yet open question, namely, what I would do with my life. For that, I thank Don Lipset. Pierre F. Goodrich had nothing to do with auto tires or blimps. You don't need me to tell you that, but I can't resist in these premises recalling the 83 or so times I have listened to Liberty Fund officers open a Goodrich seminar with an introduction to Pierre F. Goodrich that moved so gracefully from that disclaimer to the inspiring story of Goodrich's entrepreneurial success and moral accomplishment. What has been so remarkable in this tremendous history, for me nearly 20 years, has been the constant freshness Liberty Fund officers have brought to the task without ever bowdlerizing the story. Indeed, it shortly became for me a mark of the Liberty Fund officers' fitness for the office, how rhapsode-like they could give themselves up to the story of Pierre F. Goodrich. Goodrich was, of course, a lawyer, educated as a youth at Harvard, if that be not a contradiction in terms. But just as America was once a happier land, Harvard was once a home of learning. And so it arose that despite a vocation in law and businesses as diverse as newspapers, banks, and public utilities, Goodrich was above all a man of learning and conversation. And it was in the pursuit of this last, though never separated from his vocation, that Pierre F. Goodrich came to reflect on the necessary conditions for pursuing gentlemanly vocation and human society. His understanding and his genuine concern led him into the company of scholars and entrepreneurs who took to heart the growing signs of a crisis in their time, a crisis of ideas, a crisis of institutions. In this context, he came to dwell upon liberty, endangered liberty, and the idea of a society of free and responsible individuals. At length, though, Goodrich came to see liberty as the key. He thought that frequent and disciplined conversation about liberty was called for if there were to be any chance that imperfect men might bear any helpful influence in the crisis we faced. It is no academic drill, therefore, to ask the question, why liberty? What I have learned from Goodrich's essay, and also from his basic memorandum, and indeed, I must say, from entering the life to which he advised all of us, in a way, what I've learned is that while statism is the very image of the crisis, that one word, statism, is not a sufficient answer to the question, why liberty? In the opening of the essay, which was presented, by the way, at the 1958 Mont Pelerin meeting at Princeton, Goodrich took on the heady challenge of responding to the case for expediency in economic matters, that moral principles can also inform such questions. And he implied, perhaps sometimes decisively, moral principles could inform such questions. Now, regarding the case for expediency, I want to quote him. This position usually deals with parts of a whole while ignoring the whole. At the very least, it implies an unwillingness to face the whole, even as a theoretical premise. Now, it's this phrase, a theoretical premise, which I think is our key. Goodrich thought the evidence of man's imperfection derived not from a catalogue of his sins, but from the evident incompleteness of his knowledge, existing simultaneously with the necessary quest for knowledge. The theoretical premise is the condition of the quest for knowledge, and any premature closing of the inquiry, including dogmatic denials of the potential for knowledge, results in confining man for the purposes of guiding conduct, economic or otherwise, with admittedly imperfect constructs. Now, immediately after Goodrich has posed this question regarding expediency and moral principles, he asks, should man be free? In the context, this does not mean politically free. It means morally free. Nor does morally free mean free from morality. But Goodrich doesn't derive a counsel of hopelessness from this. To underline his argument, he details leading characteristics of man. He says man reasons, man learns, man has attachments, such as family particularly. Man is moved by love, by compassion, by fortitude. Man is moved by envy, by hate, by jealousy. Man wills his conduct according to these attributes, in all which man acts under the impress of moral necessity. Nor is it less true that the attributes which magnify man's imperfections, such as the inflation of power, lead him to act under the impress of moral necessity, although generally speaking, unhappily. To act under the impress of moral necessity is to act towards some end. And when Goodrich questions whether economics is an end or whether liberty is an end, he prepares us for his conclusion. Before I go into that, let me say this. It is not characteristic to talk so seriously as I speak this evening about the ideas of Pierre F. Goodrich. I recognize in setting out that I run the risk of violating what is a de facto orthodoxy, the orthodoxy of converting Pierre F. Goodrich's well-known skepticism into something more robust, indeed possibly even a theory. But relax. This is not serious because it violates what is the general understanding of the tendency of Pierre F. Goodrich's work. It's serious because Pierre F. Goodrich was serious. When Pierre F. Goodrich denies that economics is an end, or we might say to deny that economics is an end, is a thing which is possible for him only because economics is an instrumentality. It is a means to acquire things useful toward an end. But that in itself will not distinguish economics from a liberty founded in imperfection. As I said earlier, the defense of liberty is the prevention of premature closure. If one held out the final possibility of discovering and living in truth, then liberty would be no less a means than economics, a way station towards our resting place. Goodrich concludes, however, that maximum freedom is necessary since man is part of an ordered universe, but in his nature, unable to create the ordered universe within himself. Thus, man's imperfection is not a temporary state. It is man's permanent state here below. His liberty, then, is his best state, not merely his most desired state. It is not the means to an end. It is an end, although simultaneously a means to the best that man is capable of. Let's use Goodrich's words. I am not concerned with man's desire to be free. I am concerned with man's necessity to be free. Now, I submit that it is this perspective which made it possible for Pierre F. Goodrich to offer what one might not have expected from the Socrates of American business, namely a definition of the ideal government. He offered it in his basic memorandum,
in these words: the ideal would be decentralized, free, competitive, and representative political society limited to preventing force or intimidation over man. Obviously, statism could not survive this definition of the ideal government. Still, it is true that our crisis is too slight a regard for the necessity of liberty, even more than it is too fond a regard for the illusion of state security. Still, let's do justice to the fears of statism, which may have moved Goodrich less than it does some others. I offer what I take to be a fair but non-literal rendering of his view. And in this view, I submit we can recognize the key to his conception of liberty, which serves to unlock the door on his moral reflections. A practical, if somewhat metaphorical, expression of the problem P.F. Goodrich sought to deal with is the human, all too human, temptation to apply a collective scratch to what is only an aggregate itch. The itch is the imperfection which affects each and every one of us in a particular way. In the aggregate, we all itch. But that is a mere summing up of individual phenomena, which cannot operate to create a single phenomenon of general characteristics. Thus, whenever some imagine that because we can count the totality of itches, we ought to be able to devise a single, general, and usually governmental scratch to relieve each and every itch in a single sweep of the legislative pen, we succumb to the fallacy of overgeneralization. This, in turn, accomplishes nothing more than the magnification of imperfections and hence the enlargement of our dangers. Where each of us could handle his own itch with a timely applied personal scratch, none of us individually can shrink the blistering that results from the collective scratch. Liberty does not promise that we will not itch. Liberty promises that we can manage the itches we ordinarily experience. Society, political society, ideally, would be an association in virtuous effort, not an association in power. That is the reason it is apt to say of Pierre F. Goodrich that he introduced moral deliberations, or moral authority, into the deliberations of ordinary life, without depriving individuals of the moral authority, indeed, the moral responsibility to chart their own courses.